The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From Chevy Chase's bumbling portrayals of President Ford to Tina Fey's channeling of Sarah Palin to Larry David's spot-on Bernie Sanders impression, politicians are red meat for comedians. But for some comics, impersonating a candidate is not enough.
And the name of the party is Humor for Humanity. Humor in helping, humor in healing, humor and hope. Ha, ha, ha. And that's what they chant at my rallies. Ha, ha, ha. So if you hear something tonight, ladies and gentlemen, that resonates in your soul and moves your spirit, let freedom ring. Yes, you can.
Jimmy Tingle is a seasoned stand-up comedian and political humorist from Boston. And yes, he is running for president. He's going to be stumping at the Barley House in Concord on Saturday afternoon, at New England College in Concord on Saturday night, and again on Monday right before the primary. And Jimmy Tingle, what a pleasure to welcome you to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me, Virginia. Great to be here.
Well, I'm glad you're here. This is not, however, your first bid for the White House.
This is not. I like Mitt Romney, have run several times before. I ran in 2008. Not. I was not elected. I ran in 2012. I was not elected. I ran in 2000. I was not elected. But if you don't keep trying, you'll never win the White House.
So how has your platform changed through these many iterations?
Well, one of the things I'm doing, Humor for Humanity, is a social enterprise. So it went from an idea as the name of a party, a fictitious party, to now actual a social enterprise that we're trying to do is be more than entertainment, use entertainment for purposes beyond just entertainment. We aspire to raise spirits, funds, and awareness for nonprofits, charities, and social causes. Our mission is their mission, Humor for Humanity. Humor in helping, humor in healing, humor in hope. Ha, ha, ha.
Well, you certainly have the messaging down, Jimmy.
Thank you.
I guess that's
well, I've
part
had
of the 12 job.
Years. I've had 12 years to practice.
So, as a comedian, though, yes. What do you make of this presidential election? Is this a pretty good year?
Oh, it's a great year. It's a great year. You know, I wasn't going to do it again. And then I started to watch C-SPAN and I started to watch the stump speech, and I've watched every debate. I said, you know, I have to jump back in. For me, it's a wonderfully cathartic release. I get to talk about what I want to talk about in a funny way. I get to sometimes make serious points that some other folks might not be making or might be making, but not with the same spin on it. And so I find it great. It's what I love to do. I'm a been a performer since the early 1980s, and I'm still doing it, and I really love it. So it gives me both an opportunity to comment on what everybody in the country is commenting on and reflect on it and make people laugh and entertain, but also with the Humor for Humanity component, there's an actual call to action that can be really beneficial. And that's what I love most about the whole thing.
Let's hear some of your Humor for Humanity platform in action.
Humanity. What I want to do, I want to take the great political principles of the United States of America, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, and free enterprise, and combine them with the great spiritual principles of all the world's major religions that focus on love, compassion, forgiveness, mercy, justice, and peace. Combine these two great social forces so our domestic policies and our foreign policies reflect who we are and who we aspire to be.
Well, you certainly are optimistic.
Well, you have to be. You can't run for president for four times and not be optimistic.
Well, was your family political growing up?
We were, actually, in a local sense, in a very local sense. My Uncle Joe was actually the first Italian-American on the Cambridge City Council in the 1940s. And he actually helped John F. Kennedy when John F. Kennedy first ran for Congress back in the 40s, I think in 1948 or whatever. He was one of the gentlemen who helped him take him around to the Italian-American clubs at the time. And they became friends. And I recently read an interview that he did after President Kennedy was assassinated in May of 1964, I believe. Within the first 6 months, he did for this article for the Library of Congress, I believe it was. And it was a great interview where he talked about how Uncle Joe's family, my mother's brother, had 10 kids in the family. They all pitched in. They all stuffed envelopes. They all, you know, they met Bobby and Ted when they were all running in that ward politics and the old ward politics of big cities, and which is still, to an extent, very well and alive today. Mm-hmm. But this is at a time when John F. Kennedy was not a particularly polished speaker or a seasoned candidate at all. He was very young, and he there was a lot of animosity toward him because he was wealthy, he was Harvard educated, and even the townies in Cambridge, you know, who served on this Cambridge City Council, did not go for John F. Kennedy when he ran for Congress. They went for another gentleman named Neville, who was a townie from Cambridge, and he was Irish, working class, and that was their guy. And even Tip O'Neill at the time went for Neville. Tip O'Neill told a funny story years later. He's sitting in the White House. He's with Ted Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and John F. Kennedy. He said, you know, if I knew that this is the way it was going to turn out, I never would have backed Neville. So my mother, this has been handed
ever
down.
Ever the politician, yeah. Tip O'Neill.
Yeah. And this has been handed down through the ages. So that's, yes, to answer your question, we were involved in ward politics growing up.
Well, you, all right, let's call them like we see them. You got your master's from Kennedy School of Government in 2010. No easy feat. Why did you do it?
I had been doing comedy at that time since, like I said, the early 1980s. I had a theater in Davis Square, Somerville, Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater.
I've been.
And I loved doing it. But after 5 years, I was just, you know, I think I want to do something different. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but people kept saying, you know, you do a lot of philanthropic work. You do a lot of social commentary in your shows. You're, you know, engaged with different causes and everything. You should consider the Kennedy School. And I said, really? I mean, it was always something that I never dreamed of going to. I always secretly would love to have gone to the Kennedy School. I didn't think I would fit in. I'm a comic. I'm not from the world of really public policy or anything. But I applied and I got in. And it was just one of the most rewarding years of my life. Absolutely. And that's where I got the idea to try to create something using entertainment for purposes beyond just entertainment, with humor for humanity. And there are so many wonderful people. They're so inspiring. However, the cultural conversation that is entertainment, a lot of these people are not involved in it. Mm-hmm. They're doing great work, both domestically and internationally, but they're very rarely on the radio, very rarely on television, very rarely reaching a mass audience. So I said, well, you know, if I can figure out a way to use entertainment for purposes beyond just entertainment and try to incorporate and give a platform to those people and organizations, I think that would be both a lot of fun and a great contribution. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, you've really put it to work. And you gave the commencement address the year that you graduated. Let's hear just a clip of that.
I'm a comedian by profession. And I started performing here in the Boston area in the early 1980s. I actually did street performing right out here in Harvard Square. I've traveled all over the world performing stand-up comedy. I don't want to brag, but 2 years ago, I performed in Europe.
That's my guest, comedian and presidential candidate Jimmy Tingle, giving the graduate school commencement address at Harvard University in 2010. Well, we all know politics is partisan, right? But is political comedy partisan? I mean, from what I'm hearing from some of the things that you said, you sound like a Democrat.
I'm a registered Democrat. I am. And what I do with my shows is I try to be funny about what's going on and use my commentary, my sensibilities to both entertain and perhaps enlighten and either reinforce or question or engage in myth-busting around certain things. For example, one of the things that just drives me nuts is was a big article in the New York Times about a month ago by PolitiFact, the fact-checking organization, mm-hmm. that said all politicians lie, some more than others. And I was fascinated by this article because it surveyed the political statements and the public statements of 21 American political figures. And the range went from true to mostly true to false to mostly false to definitely false.
Pants on fire, yes, is one of theirs. I love.
And I couldn't believe the degree to which people are making false statements and there's no consequences. Donald Trump, 76% of his statements, false or mostly false. Ted Cruz, 66% of his statements, false or mostly false. Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton tied, I think it was 26 or 27%, false or mostly false. And Bill Clinton, 24% false or mostly false. Now, the bad news is there's a ton of disinformation that's confusing people. The optimistic or the look on the positive side is Bill Clinton is the most truthful politician on the American in the American
That's
landscape.
Saying something.
So I guess we're making progress, I think.
Well, you're obviously not the first comedian to run for president. Stephen Colbert, Roseanne Barr, and famously Dick Gregory and Pat Paulson. You remember the Pat Paulson?
Yes.
We Can Be Decisive, probably, I think was one of his.
It was wonderful.
So you're talking about serious things like, you know, people lying and there being absolutely no consequences. Can comedy be one of the tools for calling people to account?
Absolutely. I mean, you look at the effectiveness of The Daily Show or The Colbert. Absolutely, it can. But to reinforce what you just said, can it be, I mean, have you heard anybody else call for a bull detector? Have you heard anybody else call for fines? I mean, let's face it, everybody watching television, in effect, is a consumer. We're a consumer of news. We're a consumer of information. So as consumers, if we're being given false information, there should be some sort of consequences. And it should be, and I don't know who would implement it, but I mean, some things are just not true. And it's constantly being said on television or on radio. And I just think there should be some sort of consequences and hold people accountable for what they're saying.
But, you know, go back to John Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
The Kennedys, they did some dirty politicking when they were...
It's both sides.
So, right. But I'm just saying that this has been going on forever, I guess, is what I'm saying.
But
misinformation gets spread. This is how it goes. Is that not the story of politics in America?
It is. But what the story of politics in America and around the world is also progress and reforming systems. And that's one of the purposes of elections, to reform systems, to reform, to make that which we have better and to improve upon it. Same thing with the debates. It drives me nuts that one party, you know, they have to have collusion with the candidates and the candidates have to agree to certain debates. This is America. We're supposed to be a pedestal. American democracy is supposed to be on a pedestal as an example to the world. It shouldn't be up to the candidates whether or not they want to debate or not. It's like we have to have standards, in my opinion, standards for the presidential debates where people get asked the same questions. They have the same amount of time to answer. And, you know, and not have this free-for-all, people talking over people, not answering the question, not attending the debate if they don't want to. I mean, it's crazy. And on the Democratic side, we've got people that they're scheduling debates, it appears, to give the advantage to one candidate. And I don't think that's right and fair, regardless of my political views. We got to work on principles in America. Political principles, what is the principle of democracy? And those are the things that I think that I would like to bring out to the forefront in my shows and in my Tingle for President, the funniest campaign in history, humor for humanity.
Well, maybe Guatemala is a better example of a democracy where Jimmy Morales, a former TV comedian, became president.
Mm-hmm.
It can happen here.
How's he doing?
I don't know.
Maybe you can put me in the cabinet.
Well, Jimmy Tingle, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jimmy Tingle, comedian and presidential candidate. He's going to be stumping at the Barley House in Concord on Saturday afternoon and at New England College Concord on Saturday evening and again on Monday night. That's before the primary. Line up. With presidential primary stakes heating up in New Hampshire, candidates are pulling out all the stops at rallies and town halls to get voters fired up. This includes playing songs with not such subtle messages and usually a signature anthem when the candidate takes the stage. But what if those songs are used without permission? Can that be considered fair use? Michael Olivas, the rock and roll law professor, looks back at some of the most famous cease and desist cases.
It's a legal matter, baby. A legal hitting the campaign trail, or cease and desist from playing my song. Class number 17. As the endless cycle of Election Day appears, especially in presidential campaigns, candidates try as they might to identify with the people and have the people identify with them. One of the more common campaign devices is to use a popular song as part of the candidate's public image. While anyone who wishes to sing someone else's song may do so, provided appropriate fees are paid to the composer, using a particular version of the performer's rousing song is another matter. If a given performer does not like the politics of the person using the song, he or she can invoke performance copyright protections and deny the use of that particular version of the song by the campaigner. This often takes the form of a public shaming and a request that the campaign not use the song. If that doesn't work, the situation can escalate to a cease and desist order. If the matter is still unresolved, it can lead to a lawsuit to prevent use of the song. By a rough count, almost 24 songs have been banned from use in a political campaign. The number one violator, Senator John McCain from Arizona, who was refused by more than 6 singers. For example, during his 2008 presidential campaign, McCain was contacted by John Mellencamp over his unauthorized use of Our Country and Pink Houses, even though the singer allowed Democrat John Edwards to use the song. McCain also misused the Foo Fighters' My Hero, Van Halen's Right Now, and Orleans' Still the One. McCain was also issued a cease and desist order from ABBA, not letting him use Take a Chance on Me. Now, when Sarah Palin used Hart's Barracuda, she was also asked by the group to stop doing so. Mike Huckabee was asked by Boston not to use More Than a Feeling, but here I would have offered a special exception to Huckabee, who as governor of Arkansas had actually pardoned a speeding ticket in the state against the Stones' Keith Richards. Most of the artists who were violated issued public objections. In my view, the best refusal has to be that of Rage Against the Machine's Tom Morello, who wrote a sarcastic op-ed denouncing Paul Ryan for even saying how much he liked Rage's music. Ryan's running mate, Mitt Romney, was also bitten by a band when he tried to use Silver Sun Pickup's Panic Switch and was later sent a cease and desist letter. In addition to losing in the 2012 GOP presidential primary, Newt Gingrich also lost when he was ordered to stop using two songs, Survivor's Eye of the Tiger and The Heavy's How Do You Like Me Now? Hey Newt, how do you like me now? In earlier campaigns, Ronald Reagan was sent a cease and desist letter by Bruce Springsteen for his misappropriating Born in the USA, as was George H.W. Bush, W.'s father, for his campaign's use of Bobby McFerrin's Don't Worry, Be Happy. Several of these disputes resulted in actual litigation after the artist's efforts to stop the unauthorized use of the song failed. In one great example, Florida Governor Charlie Crist was sent a cease and desist order by David Byrne and the Talking Heads for their song, Road to Nowhere, in his U.S. Senate campaign. Crist kept using the song, and so Byrne sued him over unauthorized usage, and the judge ordered Crist to go on YouTube and issue a public and often visited apology for his transgression. Jackson Brown successfully sued John McCain, who else, for his use of Running on Empty and received an undisclosed settlement for his performance copyright. Now, what patterns evidence here? Virtually all of these rock songs were withheld from national Republican campaigns. A number of country stars have supported GOP candidates, as has rock and roller Ted Nugent. I could only find one public cease and desist order ever issued against a Democrat candidate, President Obama, who was asked not to use Hold On, I'm Coming by the lead singer of Sam and Dave, Sam Moore. Now, Moore did not allow any politicians to use his music, as he had also refused permission earlier to allow Bob Dole to use his song, Soul Man, for a parody version, Dole Man. What's the point, Bob? If you're a Democrat, your rock and roll catalog's waiting for you. If you're a Republican, you'd better like country music or be a fan of Ted Nugent.
And
I'm proud to be
an American. And that was Michael Olivas, professor at the University of Houston Law Center, otherwise known as the Rock and Roll Law Professor. Well, this election cycle has seen its fair share of artists balking at politicians using their music. Pop superstar Adele publicly announced through a spokesperson that she has not given permission for her music to be used for any political campaigning. That was after Donald Trump played Rolling in the Deep and the theme from Skyfall at some of his rallies. Trump has also come under fire from Aerosmith for using Dream On. And REM delivered an expletive-laden rant after Trump played their song, It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. Trump does appear to have an ally in the rapper Azalea Banks, who publicly endorsed the candidate on Twitter this week. So maybe we'll be hearing more of her music at his events.
Hey, I can be the answer. I'm ready to dance when the band...
And in December, Marco Rubio's campaign was issued a cease and desist from the Swedish EDM duo Axwell and Ingrosso for playing their song, Something New, at his campaign stops.
I see the dawn of a new...
Perhaps the answer to not running afoul of musicians and their copyrights is for candidates to release an album of their own. Well, coming up, we'll get the story behind Senator Bernie Sanders' folk album after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
The banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door.
That unmistakable voice is none other than Senator Bernie Sanders performing Pete Seeger's union song, The Banks Are Made of Marble. It's from his 1987 album, We Shall Overcome. Politics and music have been known to mix. Take then-Governor Bill Clinton playing saxophone on the Arsenio Hall show in 1992. Or now former candidate Mike Huckabee jamming on the bass with his band Capital Offense. Though the Bernie Sanders folk album may be among the most perplexing. Here to shed some light on how the then-Burlington, Vermont mayor, Bernie Sanders, found himself in the music studio is Anthony Fisher. He reviewed the album for Reason.com. And Anthony, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how did this album come to be?
Well, the owner of a local Burlington studio was just looking for any excuse to book some sessions in his studio. He was well connected with a lot of local studio musicians, was a big fan of then Burlington Mayor Bernie Sanders' politics, and just thought it would be a fun idea to pair him up with some of these local musicians and in a project that he described as Vermont's answer to We Are the World, which for those of your listeners who might be under the age of 35, was the Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie supergroup created as a benefit record for African famine relief in 1985. I don't know that they had a specific cause or charity in mind, but Bernie Sanders was open to doing it. And it didn't take too long for them to realize that Bernie had no rhythm and was basically tone deaf. So they got rid of the original plan, which was to have him actually sing all the songs. And instead, you know, in his unmistakable cadence, as you heard, chose to speak the lyrics and even in some of the cases present some of his own spoken word original prose to go along with the session musicians who some of whom would later sing their own vocals on the tracks.
Your quote from the studio owner Todd Lockwood in your article said, "This is a guy who couldn't even tap his foot to music coming in over the radio."
I mean, Bernie is not. It's funny that compared to Barack Obama's insurgent candidacy in 2008, where he was all polish and glamour, Bernie is disheveled. Bernie is the opposite of glamour, and yet that appears to be his appeal. is the authenticity of schlubbiness.
Well, let's hear just a little bit more from his album. This is Bernie Sanders' version of Where Have All the Flowers Gone?
Where have all the soldiers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the soldiers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the soldiers gone? Gone to graveyards, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn?
It's hard not to think of Larry David doing Bernie, doing this album in some way. How was the album received at the time?
It wasn't really received much at all. It didn't really go much further past the Burlington region. At one point, I think the guy who owned the studio had no original copies of the record himself. It had pretty much just sunk without a trace. And even with Bernie's ascendance into Congress, it didn't really resurface until very recently.
Well, I imagine the Sanders campaign would want this to remain sunken without a trace. How have they reacted to this album coming back out?
They've tried their best to ignore it. It's actually popped up a bunch over the past year, although in the last week or so, it's gotten a lot of attention. Like Jimmy Fallon actually played it on his show. I believe an ABC reporter played it for Bernie. And even though Bernie has gone on the record saying that it was a huge mistake to participate in this record, when the cameras were on him and somebody was playing the record for him, he joked that he was trying to get in the groove and didn't want to be distracted. And he had a very good sense of humor about it.
Okay, I want to move to a lighter topic, if you don't mind. We've got something to play for you. Does this sound familiar?
I'm getting in the groove here. Does sound very familiar. 25 years ago.
Okay, so out of 4 stars, what do you think you'd give the album, Anthony?
I mean, musically, I'd got to give it a 1. It's pretty, you know, the musicianship, you know, is certainly competent but uninspired. Bernie, you know, is a terrible singer with no rhythm. But if I was grading on a curve as far as just a novelty record, it's a 4. It's an absolute classic. No matter what happens, whether Bernie gets the nomination or not, this is a political totem that I hope does not get forgotten down the memory hole.
Anthony Fisher, a writer and producer for Reason.com and for Reason TV, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
And you can find a link to Anthony's review of Bernie Sanders' folk album. You can hear some of the cuts for yourself at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway.
Boy, for equal time, I wish we could find something of Hillary Clinton singing off-key.
Yeah, that'd be good. I think she's been much more careful with her with what she puts out in the world over the last few decades.
Anthony, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time. So in the interest of fairness, we did a little digging around and discovered that Hillary Clinton has indeed sung publicly. Here's a clip of then First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton on the Rosie O'Donnell Show in 1997.
Well, now, I don't know. I know you're busy. You can't watch the show every day, but I tend to sing occasionally.
I've heard that. I've actually seen you sing.
You have? Yeah.
I have. I've seen
your wondering
show.
If you perhaps might want to do a little Bye Bye Birdie with me.
Do you think anybody will hear me?
No one will hear.
Okay.
No.
Well, nobody hears me. I'll be okay.
All right. Take it, John. You
Hi,
jump
Nancy.
Right. All right. Sorry. I stepped on your line. Go again. My fault. Go.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Helen.
What's the story? Morning glory.
What's the tale? Nightingale.
Tell me quick about Hugo and Kim.
Hi, Margie.
Hi, Alice.
What's the story? Morning glory.
What's the word? Hummingbird.
Have you heard about Hugo and Kim? Did they really get...
The 1952 presidential campaign pitted the immensely popular General Dwight David Eisenhower against the ferociously intellectual and intensely private Adlai Stevenson. It was an election fought on a new battleground, television. This story is part of the Contenders series, portraits of some of America's most original presidential candidates, produced by Radio Diaries.
My name is Newton Minow. In 1952, I worked as assistant legal counsel to Governor Adlai Stevenson.
Stevenson's the only one, and he wears no boss's coats.
My name is Adlai Stevenson, Adlai Stevenson III. I'm the son of Adlai Stevenson II, who ran for president of the United States in 1952.
We were in the midst of the Korean War. President Harry Truman was extremely unpopular. The country's view of the Democratic Party was very, very low. The opponent on the Republican side was General Dwight Eisenhower, who was one of the most beloved, popular persons in the country. He had won the war for the American people. He could have had the nomination of either party.
Yeah, it was shaping up to be a very difficult year for the Democrats.
Until a few months ago, the name of Adlai Stevenson meant little to the people of the United States.
My name is Jean Baker, and I wrote the book The Stevensons, a biography of an American family. Adlai Stevenson had been the governor of Illinois, but he had not been involved in politics for very long.
But he was very well educated. He had gone to Princeton, and he had written and spoken a great deal. And Adlai believed that a political campaign is an educational process. It's an education for the voter, and it's an education for the candidate.
And so Stevenson decides to go throughout the country and create a informative, moving seminar for the voters. Here's what he said. Let's talk sense to the American people.
Governor Adlai Stevenson, who receives an enthusiastic welcome in Baltimore, the governor expresses himself forcefully on the subject of taxes.
I don't like taxes. I doubt if anybody does. I shall do everything I can to reduce them, but I shall make no promises that I know I cannot keep.
He had great faith in the public, great faith in the voters. Adlai believed that you don't just tell them what they want to hear, you tell them the truth.
And I'll bank on the American people. I'll bank on them even in an election year to understand straight talk and the need for a balanced budget in this country.
Adlai Stevenson's strength, which was these brilliant speeches that he gave, during the presidential campaign against Eisenhower, they became a liability.
Ike for president, Ike for president. You like Ike, I like Ike. Everybody likes Ike for president. Hang out the banner, beat the drum. We'll take Ike to Washington.
The people who did the Eisenhower campaign were Madison Avenue advertising executives. My name's David Schwartz. I'm the chief curator of the Museum of the Moving Image. It was Rawson Reeves who was most famous for Eminem melts in your mouth, not in your hands. He's the one who really knew that you could kind of boil a campaign down to a little soundbite or a jingle. And millions of people saw that ad and decided they liked Ike.
Vote for Eisenhower.
Adlai Stevenson, he didn't really believe in things like this. Stevenson just didn't even like the idea of commercials at all. He just felt like, you know, you shouldn't try to sell a presidential candidate the same way you would sell cereal or soap. He just thought this is not what politics is about.
For more than 23 centuries, humanity has striven to attain the ideal.
The Stevenson campaign decided early on that they would buy 30-minute blocks of time on TV and he would do speeches, 30-minute speeches.
If each of us lives up to the moral and the ethical obligations of citizenship.
But nobody tuned in to watch them.
Adlai Stevenson goes west. The Democratic candidates tour includes stops and speeches in Wyoming, Utah, Oregon, Washington, and Texas.
He was on a platform campaigning, and a photographer below the platform took a photograph, which included the sole of his shoe, which had a hole in it. And that photograph became a symbol of this man who, you know, really was thinking more about the issues than he was his shoes. And it caught on, and suddenly buttons were sprouting with, you know, in the shape of a shoe with a hole in it.
I'd rather have a man with
a hole in his shoe than a hole in everything he says.
The symbol that many people have held is that Stevenson is frugal. Look, here's his candidate, and he even walks around with holes in his shoe. But the real story of that photograph is that Stevenson, moments before he's going to give this speech, he's not doing what politicians usually do. They point in the second row to Betty, who's helped him on the campaign trail, or Harold, who they think is in charge of the local newspaper. But Stevenson does none of that. He's looking down at his text and making corrections.
This is the final night before one of the most vital elections in the history of our country. Tomorrow, you, the voter, will make the final decision.
On the eve of the election, Stevenson intended to make this last speech one of his best.
Looking back, I am not wholly content that I have said, or said well, everything that was in my heart. Talking sensibly and honestly is not always easy. It means saying things that sometimes people don't like to hear. It means risking votes, and candidates are not supposed to do that.
He's into this brilliant end-of-campaign speech. But they had only paid for 30 minutes, and time ran out.
People who still believe in one another, in spite of all the timid, doubting men.
And what the viewers saw at home was Stevenson still talking, but they cannot hear him.
You know, he probably wasn't paying any attention to the red lights that were going on and off and the hands that were being waved at him. He was concentrating on his message, and he didn't want to cut it short.
Electric signs flash the news, lights in, and bedlam breaks out amongst the Republican supporters as they hear of their landslide victory.
The victory for Eisenhower was overwhelming. I think Adlai carried just a few states. He was never bitter about it. Oh, he wanted to win, of course. But I heard him say this more than once. There are worse things that can happen to a person than losing an election.
We're gonna choose the God that we love. He is the God nobody can.
And that story was part of the series Contenders, Portraits of America's Most Original Presidential Candidates, and was produced by Joe Richman and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries. Maybe you're among the many people who have seen an excerpt from Nelson Mandela's 1994 inaugural address, which begins, "Our deepest fear is not that we are weak. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us." Only Mandela never said it. In reality, it's from a 1992 book called A Return to Love by best-selling author Marianne Williamson. While honored to be mistaken, Williamson has no idea how the quote was attributed to Mandela. She herself has written 6 New York Times bestselling books, 4 to hit number 1 on that esteemed list. Marianne Williamson is known in some circles as Hollywood's favorite self-help guru, but she's giving a reading and talk right here in Concord at the Capital Center for the Arts tomorrow, February 4th. Well, with such a popular writer in our midst, we just had to invite her to do a 10-minute writer's workshop and find out a little more about what goes into the process of writing a spiritual book.
This is Marianne Williamson with a 10-minute writer's workshop.
Well, Marianne, thank you so much for joining us. I'm wondering what's harder for you to write. Is it the first sentence of a book or the last?
Definitely the first. I always think of myself as being pregnant with a book. You know, I remember reading Annie Lamott's great book, I think it was called Bird by Bird, right, about writing. And she is one of those people, and I'm sure on some level she's correct, about the need for a writer to write every day. I can't write every day, maybe on Facebook or something. But with a book, I'm one of those, when Hemingway said, when the story's not writing itself, put your pencil down. I'm pregnant until it's labor. And until it's labor, there's no point in even trying. So the first sentence might be difficult. By the last sentence, if that thing's not writing itself, then you're in way deeper trouble.
Are there personal habits that you'd encourage writers to take up or even to avoid to become more productive as writers?
Well, I am a person who believes strongly in the power of meditation, prayer. Somebody once gave me one of those prayer candles. It was a very beautiful prayer candle, and I used it specifically. I can't remember which of my books it was. It might have been Everyday Grace. And I remember it was very much a part of writing that book. I would light that candle. I would say a prayer about the book. May it come from the highest, and so forth. We are all at the effect of this barrage of modernity today, from the internet, and it's a political year, and just popular culture and the stress of the culture. And I think a writer has to inhabit a very deep, sacred, internal place to be able to be of value to the culture that's so frenetic these days. And if you yourself are at the effect of that freneticism, what can you really contribute? So I think whatever it is for any person, a particular room or a particular desk, for me, no matter what, how many desks I bought, it all always comes back to writing on my bed. But I'm not someone who can just drop in at a Starbucks and write a page or drop in here, whatever. But then some people might. Whatever that which really so aligns your nervous system with the activity at hand that you know you can really fall into a deeper place, whatever that is for you. And if that's Starbucks, that's Starbucks. Whatever it is, though, to really honor that.
What about for you? What's your personal worst distraction from getting work done?
You know, it's difficult for me to find that place sometimes during the day. I'm someone who often finds that I awake in the middle of the night, 4:15, like clockwork half the time. It's like that witching hour. There's something about those hours and the negative ions and the very deep quiet, the deep quiet of those late, late night hours. So when I'm really into it with a book, sometimes my writing is like 4 to 6:30, where like I went to sleep at a normal hour, woke up, really find myself, my imagination, a very rich flowing place. And it's very common then, 2 or 3 hours, then go back to sleep because it's harder during the day.
What do you think is the most common mistake that new writers make?
Making it more about whether or not they'll sell, get an agent, have a bestseller, as opposed to what might I contribute to the planet. So the first-time writers, the same mistake I see is the general corruption of the culture. People wanting to be a bestseller more than they want to be a good writer.
Well, how about for you? How many were you rejected several times before getting published?
Now, see, I was pure out of naivete. In my career, the niche of my career did not exist when I started. So there was nothing to be ambitious for. And as far as a bestseller is concerned, my goal was, oh dear God, please don't let me be embarrassed. Please let me sell enough that I won't be embarrassed. I never would have dreamed. Oprah had never done that before. My book was the first one that Oprah got on, said best book, bought 1,000. There was no Oprah Club yet. So there was no, I have a vision of seeing myself on Oprah.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It didn't exist. So I was very innocent and pure and enlightened out of pure naivete, kind of idiot savant type stuff.
What was the best piece of advice that you ever got about writing?
I have gotten very little advice about writing, although probably the only piece of advice I've ever gotten about writing is a good piece of advice, and that is just start writing. Don't worry about if it's good or not. Just when you're ready, start putting words on paper. You will redo them over and over, but if you feel in the mode and it's flowing, just start writing. What do the great writers have to say? That's when I have received the most succor. You know, or the letters to a young poet, when Rilke says, only be a poet if you have to be a poet. He says to the young poet, just as Hemingway says, if the story isn't writing itself, put the pencil down. So when I read, you know, the greats, talking about creativity and writing, that was not personal advice given to me, but to me it was advice given to the ages.
Marianne Williamson, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And And that is best-selling spiritual author Marianne Williamson joining us for our podcast, The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. Marianne Williamson will be at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord tomorrow, and you'll find details on the events at wordofmouthradio.org. And to cruise our catalog of other authors in the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop series, go to wordofmouthradio.org or sign up for the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop podcast on iTunes. Thanks so much for joining us today. We do invite you to share what you heard with others. Just go to wordofmouthradio.org. There you'll find a deep list of segments to listen to post on social media, or to email to friends. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please keep sharing them with Word of Mouth from NHPR.